Francisco. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. One undeniable aspect of being human is to wonder about the future. Just what is going to happen? Well, we're going to look at some changes we can expect to see over the next 10 years. Paul Saffo is a research fellow at the Institute for the Future in Menlo Park, California. He specializes in both the commercial and the social aspect of new information technologies. I'll speak to him about how our lives will be changed. I'll also talk with Mary Cronin. She's on the faculty at Boston College, and her latest research is in the area of how businesses have begun to use the Internet. We'll look at this new phenomenon, which is happening right now. Paul Saffo is a research fellow at the Institute for the Future, specializing in information technologies. I recently heard him say, "The trouble with Silicon Valley is that it's a place that eats its young." I asked Paul what he meant by that.
The Valley's a very Darwinian place, just the ferment of all the startups, and expectations get very high very early, and the Valley can be very, very merciless to a company that doesn't deliver on its promises, as has happened with companies from Next to Computer onwards.
Yeah, I often have heard people say, well, you're either going to be a hero or a bum, but you don't get to be in the middle.
That's right. Well, that's where all the good ideas come from, is, you know, the essence of the Valley is somebody with a shoestring budget, crazy idea, and not a lot of adult supervision. And they're going to be either brilliant successes or they'll leave a smoking crater where their business once was. They'll never be in the middle. The middle comes from mainstream corporate America, where people think, this will be a good idea, maybe we should do it. But they'll never deliver a great idea. Great ideas come from small bands of maniacs pursuing unexplored territory.
Well, all those people have been working on PCs and software to feed PCs for the last decade, basically, and a little more than that. There's a new age upon us.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, the PC's dead. In fact, it died 2 years ago here in San Francisco, and we held the wake for it. It was the Apple-IBM announcement of their alliance. And it's dead in the sense that it's no longer at the cutting edge of technology change. In fact, the PC's an artifact of a bigger revolution. And that revolution was the microprocessor revolution that preoccupied us for most of the 1980s. Well, we figured out what to do with microprocessors, and now in the 90s, a fundamentally different technology is shaping change, and that's the communications laser. Despite all the attention given to microprocessors today, in fact, the big change is coming from the diffusion of ever cheaper, more powerful communications lasers.
Now, when you say communications lasers, are you talking about a laser like we see in a physics lab? What are we talking about?
Little laser diodes. Think about when you go home in the evenings, where are the lasers in your house? Well, if you have a compact disc audio player, you're listening to the music because a laser's reading the data off the disc. If you make a long-distance phone call and the sound quality is good, that's because of optical fiber, which is also a laser sending digital pulses down the fiber line. So lasers are insinuating themselves unseen into our lives the same way the microprocessor insinuated itself into our lives in the 1980s.
So just to be clear, the communications laser is sort of the hard, hold in your hand, probably.
It's a gizmo.
It's the hard gizmo that is fueling the next surge, the next wave.
That's exactly right.
Why don't we read about communications lasers per se?
Well, we don't read about microprocessors either back in the early 80s. People talked about personal computer. And it's because when a new technology comes along, it seems so strange. If we can't categorize it, we either ignore it completely or give it some other shorthand. So in the early 80s, the shorthand was personal computing, which was just the box you wrapped around the microprocessor that was suddenly cheap enough to put one on everyone's desk. We didn't know what personal computing was in 1980. But that wasn't a bug, it was a feature, because the term became a lightning rod for getting our heads around the implications of microprocessors cheap enough to have on everyone's desk.
Okay, so what are the applications which the communications laser will fuel?
Well, the best way to understand is with comparison to the microprocessor. The microprocessor ushered in a processing revolution, and the PC and its familiars were the main focus. We processed words and spreadsheets and images and the like. Standalone devices, though. In contrast, the laser is fueling an access revolution. And in contrast, it's why the PC is dead, because the PC, in its classic sense, is a standalone device. Information goes in via keyboard, cleaned up on screen, comes out via paper, doesn't connect it to anything else. Now we're mutating the PC into a device that lives in the laser environment. Increasingly, it's becoming an access device. We don't have a new term for it. I think workstation's the right word. If the 80s were a processing revolution, the 90s are an access revolution where every device that matters will be defined above all by what it connects us to, and only in a very small sense by what it processes for us.
If there's one thing that we've been reading and hearing about in the last six months that says the name of the game is changing, it has to do with the fact that suddenly there's a huge burst in wireless communications, but we haven't really seen it. We've just heard that it's coming. People are trying to get in. We hear that Microsoft has just signed a new deal to get into this area. We're hearing more and more about the Internet. Now, it's like we're kind of sick of hearing about the Internet, but still we're hearing about the Internet. This is all really tied into communications. How is that changing?
Well, communications is changing in a very big but subtle way. And the people who are having the hardest time with it, frankly, are the communications companies like cable companies and phone companies. The problem is the rest of the world is catching up with their visions, but in the process, they're changing those visions to suit the rest of the world. And so a lot of executives at phone companies are having troubles understanding what's going on in their backyard. The first big shift really is that communications for most of this century has meant people talking to people. It's the old AT&T ad. That's changed thanks to the communications laser and the microprocessor, that all the growth in communications today is not people talking to people. It's machines talking to machines on the behalf of people. An indicator in this regard is fax traffic between the United States and Japan. Less than 30% of that traffic is represented by voice conversation. The vast bulk of what remains is fax machines to and froing information back and forth. So it's a case where machines are talking to machines on behalf of people, fax machines talking to fax machines, and they're pretty stupid right now. You wouldn't trust a fax machine to get a message across without checking the out slot. But add intelligence to it, and suddenly all these devices around us begin to start doing things on our behalf without us even there.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Paul Saffo. He's a director at the Institute for the Future in Menlo Park, California, and a specialist in the long-term commercial and social impact of new information technologies. I'm always amazed at people when they say, when the computer gets here, everything will be easier. Or when such and such a technology gets here, we'll have a lot more time. When televideo conferencing gets here, we won't have to travel so much. None of these things have ever been true, from my perception. There was always more work, more people doing things, more travel. What is this? Why are they expecting things to be less instead of more?
Well, there's a very odd behavior we have when it comes to the diffusion of new technologies. We tend to pin our hopes and expectations on the nearest new technology to come along. And then when the technology fails to satisfy our inflated expectations, we turn around and assume it'll never change our lives at all. And the classic instance of this is the personal computer. In 1980, everybody thought it would be the cure for the common cold. Every home would have a personal computer in short order. It never happened, never happened, never happened. And companies like Apple and others said, we're going to give up on the home. We're just going to focus on business. Then one company came along and said, gee, what if we had a really inexpensive home computer that just did one thing very well that everybody else wants to do? That thing was entertainment. The company was called Nintendo. And the rest, as we say, is history. At the same time, even the most expected of technology revolutions unfolds in utterly unexpected ways. The microprocessor was a big revolution, but it was much bigger than the personal computer. Turns out in our society, the computers that matter most are the ones we never see at all. The average video camera today that a consumer buys at their local store has more processing power than a top-of-the-line IBM 360 had in its heyday. Why is that a revolution? Well, that kind of camera allows an ordinary citizen to shoot pictures in extremely low light, just as a citizen did of the police beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles. And that's a real revolution, not the soft and cuddly revolutions that seem to come out of Silicon Valley.
You know, there is so much focus on technology and the latest and greatest in technology. And what you were just saying now about Rodney King and the low-level light in the camera, video camera, brings it to me. You know, are we looking at the donut or the hole? The effects of on society and on our lives, both from a business point of view and just a standard living point of view, of all of this technology making its way into the infrastructure. What changes are we going to see now that information communications is going to be changed so much?
I think the big change is going to be becoming accustomed to machines doing things for us. That these days, if you have a computer, unless you're sitting in front of it doing something, it's not doing anything for you. But we're going to see more and more gizmos come into our lives that will end up doing things on our behalf when we're not there. An answering machine does that to a certain degree today, but one can imagine lots of other things like that going on. So that we'll probably, by the decade's end, end up carrying enough personal electronics on us to get nervous in lightning storms.
We've all heard about how there's going to be 500 TV channels or 50,000 TV channels, or who knows the number. There always seems to be a five in there and a lot of zeros. I'm still only looking at one at a time when I look at one at a time, when I look at it at all. What's going to happen there?
Well, for starters, it's going to happen slowly. And, you know, this race into the future is turning out to be a narrow, long, and winding road. Because what we're trying to do is something we've done before in the past, but it's very, very difficult. And that is we're taking a raw, untamed technology, and we're trying to turn it into a compelling medium that touches and changes our lives. And particularly when that's being done by multiple industries at the same time, change is very slow. Lessons from this century, that radio took 20 years to go from the technology of wireless to the medium of broadcast, and that was pretty fast. TV took 30 years plus time out from a war to go from the first broadcast atop the Empire State Building to the first commercial broadcast that mattered in the early 1950s. And part of what slowed it up was everybody had a slightly different idea about what it was going to do. Today is no different.
You know, it is interesting how the effects of what's happening in a world situation really fuels the presence of technology, even when the technology is available. When we were talking to Dick Tauber, who's head of satellites and circuits for CNN, he said that at the beginning of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, there were something like five transportables, satellite dishes, available in the world. And halfway through, there were 55. At the end, there were 155. And suddenly everybody had them. Well, now that you had them, now you see them moved all over the place, and there are many more. And it's the technology was there. It had a certain expense, but they weren't really being used. They weren't being incorporated. And it took sort of a catastrophe that impelled people to use it that moved in very quickly.
Well, you see that sudden burst of technologies, and the events in Tiananmen Square did the same thing for still video cameras. It turned out that when the Chinese shut down the satellite links, that you couldn't get video out of the country unless you hopped a train to the nearest border. But you could send out still video images over the Chinese phone system with a modem. They had one Sony Mavica in China at CNN. CNN used it, and the next day I was told there are half a dozen limousines from the networks parked in front of, you know, one Sony Circle to pick up their Mavicas as well. But another technology at Gulf Storm or Desert Storm really is another important indicator, and that was the global positioning systems used by our troops. They had a certain number of mil-spec global positioning units, but they didn't have enough for everybody. So they called up the leading manufacturer of those systems in Silicon Valley and ordered a slew of the commercial version. And so that there were soldiers in Gulf War carrying systems designed for hunters and truck drivers and the like. And it's an indicator that the latter half of this decade, consumer technology is going to drive and the business technology is going to lag behind for the simple reason that the scale of consumer technologies is so much larger. So don't look for things to come in from your office. You'll get it at home first and then you'll take it to work.
We thought we knew everybody who was in the communications business. You know, we're thinking Sprint, we're thinking AT&T, we're thinking these big international companies, but it's mostly voice. They've been saying voice and data for a while. We figured they were ready. Suddenly, a whole lot of people are jumping into communications. It seems that while we're still using the term communications, it must be a whole lot bigger place than it was before. Give us a picture of that.
Well, it's expanding dramatically because communications is changing. As we were talking about earlier, communications is now machines doing things with other machines on the behalf of people. The other dimension to it is that for most of this century, communications has been a conduit, a pipe between physical locations on the planet. But now that we have the machines in the loop, that's changing as well. Communications is now becoming a destination in its own right. The slang term for it is a cyberspace, where it's a social virtual environment where people meet and interact and spend more and more of their time. And that means that the communications sphere grows vastly more quickly than the population grows or the economy grows.
That communication between individuals through their machines, realizing it's machine-to-machine communication, has that had an effect on how organizations will operate?
Absolutely. That making what's happened is, you know, in the 1980s, when the personal computer was standalone, if you played on your computer, it was sort of a lonely asteroid existence, knocking around all by yourself inside the memory and processor. And it could be interesting for a while, but people love interacting with people much more than they like interacting with machines. And when you hook computers to things like the internet, the computer becomes a social tool. And it is a revolutionary social tool at all levels. At the organizational level, what we're seeing is the end of the corporation as we know it. It turns out that our organizational structures are such that they always resemble the communications conduits used by the companies to do businesses. So in the 1800s, the monarchic structure of companies then very closely resembled what you had because of the postal service. Then the arrival of the telegraph and later reliable telephone service changed it to a tree-like structure, the beginnings of the modern corporation. It reached its high point in the mid-60s with the advent of the mainframe, mirrored by General Motors' structure, you know, the corporation as a virtual computer. And then the computer caused that to start dissolving apart. And now it's no coincidence that the organizations that are most successful begin to resemble the web-like structures of the communications conduits they're using.
So when the computers are distributed and their ability to connect with each other within the corporation and without the corporation, the hierarchy in the corporation began to dissolve.
Exactly. Peter Drucker was the first person to note it in a marvelous article in 1987 in the Harvard Business Review. And he said, look, middle-level managers, their role is to be communications conduits, shuttling information upwards and downwards in the company. And now, thanks to computers and communications, those devices do it much better than humans. We don't need all these middle-level layers. And in fact, they're a tremendous disadvantage because they slow companies up. Look at poor old Exxon with the Valdez oil slick. It was a company that had so much middle-level management that its response was so sluggish it couldn't even outrun a creeping oil slick.
My guest today is Paul Saffo, a lawyer by training. He's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future. Paul is a frequent contributor to numerous and diverse international publications, from the New York Times to Wired Magazine. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now let's go back to Silicon Valley for an example. I think one of the reasons I like to look at Silicon Valley and how it evolved is there's a tremendous tradition in Silicon Valley that you could go there and work out of your garage and create a business, and it could just be you, and you could stay there for a long time, be a happy camper. It could grow to any size. It could become a huge international conglomerate. But there is a recurring theme about individuals can start there and they can make their own way. So there's been a trend toward individual business, small to medium business, which are fairly new businesses. Are we going to continue to see that trend, or are we now, because of the fact that the big companies, or we're talking international communications, we're talking very big things that require a lot of technology and capital to do, are we going to end up seeing a swing back to working for big businesses?
Well, what you end up with is a very complex competitive ecology, whereas the big players get bigger. There are things they can do that small players can't touch, but like lay massive amounts of fiber to American households. But in doing that, they open up new business niches for smaller companies that do things that the big players could never do. In the recent past, you've seen that with cable. Once we had a national series of cable networks in the United States, the cable companies would have been very happy just reselling network broadcasts till the cows came home. Except a couple of wackos had, you know, one set of wackos said, gee, why don't we show video music ads? And the cable company said, well, we think you're crazy, but go ahead and try it. Well, that's MTV. And another wacko said, you know, Americans really want to watch news 24 hours a day on demand. And that was Ted Turner. So that as the big monsters get bigger, they set the stage for new opportunities by small players. And it's happening in Silicon Valley again today. We hear a lot of talk about consolidation in the software industry, and you know, Microsoft's reached the size that it, you know, could purchase several Latin American countries on its interests alone and the like. But at the same time, there's probably never been a better time to do a small software startup if you've got the right idea and you're pushing at a new market. Bad time to do a new spreadsheet. But if you want to do a new kind of communications beyond email, this is a great time to do it.
Well, I think this leads me to another perspective, and that has to do with how long it takes technology to mature, be it software or hardware technology, and at what point in the cycle do you recognize that it's at? You want to get in early? What is early?
Well, it depends on the technology. In general, everything takes longer to arrive than we expect. You know, the fatal disease in Silicon Valley is to mistake a clear view for a short distance. You know, it's that sense of standing on a ridgetop and there's a distant mountain goal. It seems so close you could reach out and touch it. But then when you get down among the trees and you're whacking your way through the bushes to get there, you realize it's rather further away. And we've had a current crop of companies go belly up around pen-based computing and personal digital assistants who all mistook a clear view for a short distance. In general, it takes about 30 years for any completely new technology to fully insinuate itself into our lives as an unremarkable fact of daily life. That doesn't mean you should wait 30 years before investing, but the first decade is really the decade of the pioneers and the crazies. The second decade becomes the decade of the entrepreneurs exploiting it and creating new market niches. And then the third decade is the decade of the mega financiers. You know, sometimes it takes 20 years for things to become an overnight success. In fact, most of the time that's the case. Fax was one example of that. Another is the mouse. The mouse was invented by Doug Engelbart in the early 1960s. It languished in research obscurity until the mid-1980s with the advent of Macintosh, and then it was on our desks.
Well, we all want to know, what are the next three things that are going to be overnight successes?
I can tell you what they'll be. I can't tell you when.
Which night?
I think you'll see the notion of personal digital assistants, devices in the category that companies like Motorola and General Magic are trying to do, become an overnight success. But it's going to be a lot closer to the year 2000 than the year 1994. But the essence of it is a device you carry that is a communications device, first and foremost, and it does things for you and it helps you manage your life. That definitely will hit an inflection point and go through a takeoff and become an executive status tool. but we got a couple of rounds of failures ahead of us first. Two-way video experiences in the household is definitely going to hit an inflection point. If I had to pick a year, it would be 1997 or 1998. It's not interactive TV exactly. Interactive television is a colossal oxymoron. The only term that's more stupid than that is information highway, which is easily the most moronic term of the 20th century. TV is not interactive. If it's interactive, it's not television, because television is more in common with the Fourth Estate. You know, it's like newspapers, except it's electronic. Having a two-way channel. You know, the problem with TV is it delivers the world to your living room, but it's a one-way trip. All you can do is press your nose against the glass and watch. What we will see is we're going to turn that into a two-way trip. And we'll have some things like movies on demand, like, but those are not the big applications. The big applications will be new kinds of social experiences with other individuals and with other very large groups. And we're only beginning to see the first shadowy shapes of that stuff today. With luck, it'll become clear by the year 2000, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Well, you did ruin my last question, which was going to be, how do you feel about the term information superhighway?
New words are like the ablative shield on a spacecraft. The whole point of the shield is to burn away when the craft enters the atmosphere so the astronauts don't get cooked. And terms like information highway are terms like horseless carriage. We know they're wrong, but they're an easy way for us to start getting our heads around something that's really far more exotic. And if we realized how exotic it was, we'd all get so white-knuckled we wouldn't dive into it. Also, information highway is a good one for Washington because, you know, basically what you got is a bunch of middle-aged white boy politicians trying to get on board a bandwagon that's already underway. I mean, the information infrastructure is here. It's in the hands of the people. There are multiple competing infrastructures. And I think what you're seeing is Washington's trying to stay in that debate sufficiently that they're not frozen out of this new environment.
Quite often I'll ask someone a question about education. Where does education have to go? And I've asked famous people, and I've asked not so famous people, and I've asked people who are close to education and people who are far away from education about where does it have to go? And and by and large, I've been totally dissatisfied with all the answers. They've all been amazingly the same and amazingly boring. And we're not even going to test you, Paul. But what you've said to me, it suddenly occurred to me, in this picture you've given me, that it doesn't matter about whether they put information superhighway in the technology initiative and they're going to try to vote in things and vote out things and argue about money. It was going to happen anyway. It is happening. The biggest thing is to point at it. And when I think about education and kids and tomorrow, the fact that they're using all these video games at home, the fact that I've seen them walk up to any kind of computer, they don't care what it is, they don't care if they've never seen it before, they don't even have to read, a lot of them can't, and they'll get into whatever program's there and they'll figure it out. Already our children have a completely different agenda, a completely different scope and view of what the world is like with technology in it.
That's always happened, though. If you had dropped into the hill towns of Italy in the 1480s, you would have discovered there was a big revolution going on then, an intellectual revolution. You know, 1452 was the invention of movable type. It wasn't until 1501 that we had the first modern book. But there was a shift. Before the invention of printing, the dominant intellectual skill were the arts of memory. But it was the advent of the printing press triggered a fundamental shift. From the use of brain as storage of static, unchanging information to the use of brain as processor of information on paper. And it was a youth revolution. All of a sudden, people could read things. And of course, youth read things better than the adults because they started reading earlier. And one can imagine a scholar in Mainz, Germany in 1482 drowning his sorrows in the local beer hall because now he had six books to master instead of one. And he didn't start learning how to really read well until he was in, you know, his 20s. So today what's happening is a similar shift that, you know, the rest of us old folks think of computers as tools for processing things. What the youth has discovered is that computers are a social tool. They're a tool for interacting with other people. And moreover, it's not the information itself that matters so much as the context around the information. And just as we didn't have a term for what literacy was in that shift from memory to the ability to read, well, today, literacy is just as much of a moving target. But I think the shapes of it to come are hidden in things like information surfing, people who know how to move through very large amounts of information to hunt down exactly what they need and move on and not get too hung up on the details.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
My guest today has been Paul Saffo, a director of the Institute for the Future, based in Menlo Park, California. A book of Paul's essays entitled Dreams in Silicon Valley was recently published in Japan. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Mary Cronin has written the new book, Doing Business on the Internet. Since the Internet was developed for government and research facilities, I asked her how that could be.
Well, a lot of businesses have discovered they can do practically anything on the Internet that they used to do by telephone or by fax. In terms of communications, they can connect people all around the world. And that's one of the fundamental activities that most businesses start out with. When they link up to the Internet, they save money on telecommunications and they have a presence internationally right away. But a lot of businesses are expanding beyond that, and they're using the Internet for customer support, for different kinds of marketing to let people know more about their products and to find out how their products are being received once they're purchased. And many, many companies now are using the Internet for collaboration and partnerships with other businesses because it's a standard and you can communicate across different companies and across national boundaries as well.
You know, it is different. It speaks so much to the changing infrastructure. It used to be when you had a business, the only people that could really come and use you were people within, you know, some physical distance. You know, and then you were local and regional. And then it didn't seem that long ago when people said, well, you had to be national. And now we're saying, you know, international, so that an individual, a small business, could literally begin with an international presence using something like an Internet.
That's right. And in fact, small companies are tremendously excited by that notion of connecting to the Internet and having the whole world aware of their presence and as a potential customer, so that even one or two person organizations or startup companies now are beginning to think if they start with a connection to the Internet, they can get the word out that they're there and they can find maybe customers in Eastern Europe or in Asia who otherwise never would have ever found that they even existed. And once they're signed up with customers, once they have established this presence, they can also support them electronically instead of having to have the overhead of opening up offices or having a person somewhere else in another country. They use the Internet to communicate with customers.
Now let's start with how the Internet started, and let's describe that, because it's a little unusual in the sense that this was something that started as a government and a research tool for universities and the like, research labs, and now it's being used for business. I mean, I'm not sure how that happened, and is that legal, or what are we talking about? Tell us about that, Mary.
Yes, the Internet started really for research and as a government network in the late 60s and early 70s. And it began to connect more and more universities and research departments in large companies in the 80s. But it was really just about 3 years ago that it opened for business, in a manner of speaking. In addition to the government part of the network, commercial private networks connected to the internet and started offering internet connections to any company that wanted to pay a fee for a commercial internet connection. And as a matter of fact, in the early 90s, there was quite a lot of confusion because the government part of the internet, which is still operated by the National Science Foundation, did have a policy that the NSFnet, as it's called, is just to be used for education and research purposes. And so a lot of companies were confused. They didn't know if it was legal to get on the internet and use it for business. Was it okay to make money using the internet? And it certainly is. They have a commercial connection, and the providers of those connections are using their own private networks. They connect with each other and with the government backbone, and the traffic can flow freely. It doesn't matter, in fact, what part of the internet you connect to. The beauty of it is you get to every other part, and that includes outside the United States to almost 100 countries in the rest of the world. So it's perfectly available to do business on the internet now, and there are just a few restrictions in terms of some providers don't want any unsolicited advertising, for example, to go over the internet. And that's a good thing that that's restricted, because most people find that particularly annoying to get the equivalent of junk mail in their electronic mailboxes. And most companies learn that that's, in fact, not the best way to use the internet. It's really counterproductive, and there are better ways to reach customers.
Well, I actually kind of chuckled at one point in your book. You published the President of the United States internet address. You just fire one off to Bill, you know.
Well, as a matter of fact, Bill doesn't read those messages. They go to a machine, and it generates an automatic answer. Thank you very much for contacting the White House, and we're happy to hear from you. But I think they just do some sort of numerical tally, and maybe they select out a very small sample of those messages to actually forward to any human being. So but it was a nice touch.
Now, that's the challenge for the technical people. Well, if it's so, they only look at so many of them, I've got to send 100, and then I'll probably get through. Now, what is the president's internet address?
President at whitehouse.gov.
G-O-V.
G-O-V. And the names on the internet addresses actually do mean something. So companies have usually their company name and then something that refers to the gateway machine that it goes into in the company. And then .com or .com means that that's a commercial user of the internet. And universities are .edu for educational use, and other organizations are .org for organization. Mm-hmm. So you can already tell something about who you're communicating with from looking at their email address.
I think the people have just started to see and hear email addresses and internet addresses that and aren't quite conscious of them. You know, some people are, but aren't. Just in the last, I knew we were going to do this interview, so I said, I'm going to pay attention for the last week, you know, and say, how many times have I seen one or heard one or been asked about it? And people have asked me twice for my email address. I was listening to KQED, this radio station here, and they were taking questions for their forum program in the last several weeks. Now you can write in your ask your question, which is normally a telephone call-in program, and you could also fax your questions in. Now you can also send them in over email while the program's going on, and I've heard other Talk of the Nation, other people do it. Now it's starting to show up on business cards. You know, it's like your telephone number, your fax number, sometimes your pager number, and now your email address. So it's starting to creep in, and I think if, you know, I've seen them at the bottom of ads now. So this is actually all relatively new, right? I mean, in terms of sort of this burgeoning effect.
Absolutely. And it started in the high-tech kinds of companies and computer and software manufacturers really were connected to the internet very early on and became more and more aware of its value outside of the research and development arena for customer support or for just reaching out and publicizing what they're doing. But now it's all kinds of companies, and people really do feel somehow isolated or less than up to date if they don't have an email address to put on their business cards. And you go places, people say, oh, what's your email address? And if you don't have one, you start to feel like maybe you're really missing out on something.
My guest today is Mary Cronin. She is the university librarian at Boston College and author of Doing Business on the Internet. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now, I'm going to ask you to be just a little more technical here. If I am a company and I'm interested in getting my company and the people in it on the Internet, do I go to someone like an America Online, CompuServe? Is that what I do?
No, that's probably not the best way to go about it. Although
that's a possibility.
Those services do have now gateways into the Internet. But the gateways are really just to allow electronic mail. We've been talking about everyone getting an email address. And so you can, if you're on CompuServe or America Online, get Internet mail through their gateway. But you don't really get the full benefit of the Internet through those services. What companies do is contact an Internet service provider. And there are national providers, Alternet, Sprint is now a provider. There are also a number of local providers. So in the Bay Area, it's Barnett. Mm-hmm. And
how do you find out in your area? We go all over the world. We're actually even digitized audio on Internet. So that if I have a company somewhere, so someone could be in Australia listening to us on their Sun workstation, how do you find out who's in your area?
Well, there are a number of ways to find out. You can most easily call an organization called the InterNIC, which sounds like another little bit of jargon, but that is, in fact, a government-funded clearinghouse for information on the Internet for everyone. And they do have an 800 telephone number. I listed in an appendix to my book, and you can also contact them by fax or if you're already connected in some way by email. And they provide Internet registration services. So you can register your company name and find out about the process of connecting to the Internet. They also have a list of Internet providers all around the U.S., and they will fax that to you or mail it to you. And that's a good way to start. And you can also just ask them, because a live person really does answer their telephone. I'm in a certain city, and I'd like to know the providers in this area, and they'll direct you to the appropriate Internet provider.
This is one of these really funny things where once you're already on the Internet, then the whole world is opened up to you. And if you're not on the Internet, it's not exactly clear how you open the door.
Where is it?
Where is the door? Where is the window?
Yes, well, one of the things about the Internet that is very different and hard for some corporate people to understand is that there isn't any one Internet, and there's no organization that runs the Internet. So people in a corporate environment think about connecting. They think about, well, where's the headquarters? You know, who do I call? But it's a very distributed network. And so there are these different providers in all different locations. It's the same Internet. It doesn't matter who your service provider is. Once you connect, you have the full
every address in the world is open
exactly.
to you.
Exactly.
And you really don't know how many machines it goes through and how many providers it might go through to get there.
Right. And to a large extent, it doesn't matter. What does differentiate now some providers is they provide more support, more training, more kind of background services for companies that may not have in-house expertise to decide how most effectively to use the connection once they've got it. And as more companies outside technology areas are connecting, that's becoming a real need because they don't automatically see what they're going to do once they have the Internet up and running.
Once they have it. Well, I want to go down several different paths here. The first is that for this to become part of a business strategy, the management, the top management of a company has to comprehend what it's about. at this point in time, those tend to be the less technical people. Unless it's a new company of younger people, they haven't really grown up with technology. They can probably remember 15, 20 years ago when the big computers first came in, and people in departments would actually say, I remember hearing this at the time, saying, well, I can't type, therefore I can't use the computer. You haven't heard that in a long time. I couldn't type either, so I didn't know what they were talking about. But there is a level of technical sophistication that they may or may not need. What do you need to develop your business strategy, if you're a business person, for the internet?
Well, you mainly need to think about exactly that question. What is your business strategy? What are the possibilities that you see for using global communication and electronic mail and support services to expand your business and to maybe be better than your competition? And so the technical questions are almost secondary. And one of the reasons that I wrote my book was to really make that case to management that the internet is something that can make a difference in any number of business environments, and that you don't have to be a high-tech person to use it effectively. Obviously, there has to be someone in the company who's going to be a kind of systems administrator, network manager, technical expert, but the company management doesn't have to play that role to understand and use the internet more effectively. And one thing that I'm really happy with now that people are starting to read the book is they say, oh, yes, I can actually read this. It makes sense to me. I don't need to know a lot of the jargon and the technical information. And they're excited by the potential once they find out about how many things the internet can do for a company. So that's been really nice. I do see, though, that there's still a gap, a real information gap, in that it's true in most companies the top management is not thinking strategically about the internet. They've heard about it. They're much more aware in this past year with all the media coverage about the internet's existence and how it might fit into a national information policy for the future. But I'm still amazed that when I talk to the people at the CEO and vice president's level, they're still a little vague about exactly what the internet is going to do for their company. And interestingly, in a lot of those same companies, the people who are more hands-on are very excited about the internet and see lots of potential. So I think there's still a lot more that's going to be accomplished in using the internet in companies once that gap is overcome.
My guest today is Mary Cronin. She teaches information management at the Boston College School of Management. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I think part of essential business practice is what is changing today. People didn't have faxes 7-8 years ago. It's just starting. Do you have a fax? Don't you have a fax? And sort of the business etiquette around using them, you know, really hadn't been built up. I mean, people would actually send me, you know, 45 pages faxes. And it was like, please don't do this to me ever again. And I would send a fax to someone and they say, oh, no, this is going to cost me money with this fax coming in. They didn't understand that it was only the sender of the fax. Well, people understand about faxes now and they can see it. You're in your office, you send a fax to me. I think part of the problem with the internet is that, as you say, there's no single organization, sort of an agreement how we send information around. And secondly, you can't really see it. You have to kind of experience it. Is that true, do you think?
I think that once you get that level of confidence that the person on the other end actually did get the document or the file that you sent, and once you have the experience of retrieving information yourself and you see how quickly it comes in and how there it is, it's in your computer, you can do whatever you want with it, or once you've shared a computer exchange with someone else in another country and you're actively back and forth with communication, then yes, you do get that sense of confidence. It works. It's reliable. the material really is there. It's not somewhere out there in the ether, you know, wandering around aimlessly. And then when very seldom you have a problem with it, you realize how dependent you've become on the reliability that you normally can expect. I do think that a lot of companies, and especially management, have heard things about security problems on the internet or maybe some break-ins that you might be vulnerable to if you're connected and your company is actively using the internet. And those concerns are real, and companies have to take preventive measures. If they are going to be internet users, they want to have security. They want to make sure that they don't, in effect, leave the door open.
Well, what can happen to you?
Well, if you don't have some secure gateway to the internet, then since you're connected to a network that literally millions of other people are connected to, other people can try to figure out what your passwords are to get into your internal network. And that's where some trouble might start. So most companies now have what are called firewalls, and that's a phrase, like many on the internet, that doesn't mean anything in and of itself. But what it stands for is either a separate machine that serves as a gateway that all the traffic coming into that company over the internet doesn't come into their internal network. It comes into this separate firewall machine. And that's the, kind of at the boundary of the rest of the world and the private internal company network. And then there's various kinds of software and filtering mechanisms that can sit on those gateway firewall machines that prevent intrusive or unwanted traffic from coming in, but they still allow the people within the company to get onto the internet and do their business.
Now, you had a quote from Paul Saffo in the book, and he is with the Institute for the Future in Menlo Park, and he was talking about how the fact that all of these people from one organization to another can communicate over the internet has changed the structure of organizations from the hierarchy to one that is much more distributed in decision making. Tell us about that.
Well, that's, I think, in the long term, one of the really interesting things about participating in the internet is it completely changes the dynamic of information flow within an organization, because anyone connected to the internet can talk to millions of people around the world whenever they want to. And if they have a question, it's really just as easy for them to put that question out on a discussion group or a news group and get an answer from somewhere in Japan or Australia as it is to walk down the hall and ask someone else. And as a result, there is a lot of virtual communities springing up through these discussion groups, bringing people together and really making people much better informed about product development or new technology or networking.
Or the decision from last night's meeting.
Exactly. And a lot of companies that are aware of the power of this kind of communication are starting to replicate the internet system of discussion groups within their own companies. So, in fact, this morning I was just at Silicon Graphics, and the people there were showing me they have internally over 300 news groups that they use to keep everyone in the company informed about development projects or new things that are happening, management decisions, and even recreational groups. That it's a big company, it's distributed around the world, and this is a way for everyone to feel part of the community, but from a competitive point of view, also to keep the people in customer support aware of what's happening in marketing and happening in the development of a new product, so that all that information that might otherwise just sit in one isolated division or on someone's desktop becomes available to help people be more creative or more effective in their own jobs And I think that's tremendously powerful, and it has a very positive impact on how people perform within a company.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
My guest today is Mary Cronin. She is author of Doing Business on the Internet, published by Van Nostrum Reinhold. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called the Cambrian Explosion.
Last week, a girl of maybe 10 years old reminded me how easy it is for language to confuse that which it is intended to clarify. In the course of a talk on the demise of the dinosaurs, I was presenting a timeline in which I compressed the entire history of our planet into a single year to give my audience a temporal context in which first dinosaurs, then mammals, ruled the Earth. Carl Sagan would have approved as I strode across the stage, 500 million years at a step, expounding on the start of life around the middle of February and the Cambrian explosion around November the 17th. At the end of the talk, I invited questions, and a small hand went up. "How big was the Cambrian explosion?" the girl asked, quite sensibly. I explained that it wasn't really an explosion in the way we think of one. She looked disappointed. "But a comparatively sudden flourishing of life, an evolutionary explosion, when prototypes of all the forms we see around us today evolved." "How sudden?" she persisted. "Maybe 5 or 10 million years? Now she looked really disappointed. "It used to be thought that it had taken much longer," I added rather defensively. She let me go at that. Paleontologists, scientists who study fossils in order to understand ancient life, may play a little fast and loose with language, but what else can you call it when life, which had remained small and, to be honest, boring for over 3 billion years, suddenly took off? It wasn't a rapid development or a flourishing or even an outburst. It was an explosion. From its first appearance on Earth, somewhere between 3.5 and 4 billion years ago, until about 530 million years ago, life was essentially single-celled. Some multicellular algae developed, but they're unimportant to future developments. Then, boom! In 5 to 10 million years, a geological blink of an eye, virtually every film, or basic anatomical design, arrived. None have emerged since. It all took place in that remarkably short period, when life was having a field day with permutations, combinations, and who knows what all. Out of that zestful menage came the precursors of lupins, lobsters, lemmings, leopards, lice, llamas, locusts, lizards, loganberries, and all the rest. In short, other than bacteria and a few surviving remnants of the pre-Cambrian era, life. All in a madcap rush of wild development. Thank you for your question, ma'am. I stand by my original statement. It was, too, an explosion.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.